Good morning.
I want to acknowledge my colleagues, Sarah Garreau, who has been actively involved in this work with myself, and Melanie Beasy-Gizet, who heads the birth initiative, outcomes initiative for the state Medicaid program and is the head of the birth outcomes committee for the state of South Carolina. I have no particular financial interest or otherwise. I just want to disclose that I am the chair of the Birth Outcomes Data Committee, of which this work comes from, and it is comprised of several state agencies as well as professional organizations that are involved with it, the Hospital Association and others, and then Allison Lukacik, who at South Carolina DHHS oversees this particular initiative for the state. I want to really talk about that public-private partnership in order to improve birth outcomes, of which this comes from. It is a very large initiative within the state of South Carolina. We want to talk about a little bit of the comprehensive focus on improving maternal child health from which this stems, and then specific focus on improving the quality and safety of care for every mom and baby in the state. And then finally, to talk about the formal commitment from all South Carolina birthing hospitals related to SBIRT and the policy that comes from it. So there's several major goals, objectives associated with the birth outcomes improvement model in South Carolina. Implement health promotion education efforts, ensure quality of care for all women and infants, enhance integration for women and infants, improve maternal risk screening for all pregnant women, of which SBIRT comes under, improve access to health care for all women before, during, and after pregnancy, eliminate health disparities and promote health equity, and then to use data to understand and inform birth outcome improvement efforts. The committee that I chair actually provides to all hospitals in the state a report on a quarterly basis that gives them ongoing information regarding all birth outcomes, including SBIRT screenings, as part of their overall management quality improvement efforts. And then the Hospital Association, in conjunction with the perinatal regional centers, works with those hospitals in terms of looking at strategic efforts in order to improve a variety of different measures. So when we look at the birth outcomes environmental scan, which is something that we put together, one of the things that we did is we, using our GIS methods, we put together a series of maps that highlighted a variety of different birth outcomes across the state, moved that into a PDF Adobe platform that allowed all of the individuals to literally click and look at the content at a county level and or specifically at small units of geography. And so our notion behind it was that we wanted people to be able to have readily accessible information as we began this process of introducing why SBIRT and some of the other major initiatives within the birth outcomes made sense. And then we did that also by hospital catchment areas. So when you look at this, this is the percentage of female South Carolina Medicaid recipients, 18 to 34, with an opiate prescription, and this is something that I presented yesterday. And then we talk about high need and neighboring areas only. So this was actually the first study that we did in order to introduce this notion that screening, intervention, referral, and treatment were a key component of what we needed to do. I don't have a map for it here, but one of the things that we also did was talk about smoking during pregnancy. And again, realize that all of this was provided to a series of constituents. South Carolina is an all-payers database system. And so it allowed us to do this both for the Medicaid population as well as for Blue Cross Blue Shield. Between Blue Cross Blue Shield and Medicaid, they pay for 82% of all births in the state of South Carolina. Medicaid pays for approximately 82% of all teen pregnancies in the state. And so this partnership that was created in conjunction with the March of Dimes, as well as all the hospitals, the academy, and others, was an absolute essential step in looking at improving birth outcomes, but specifically in terms of improving SBIRT within the context of adoption and implementation in the state of South Carolina. when we looked at PRAMS, for example, and we looked at tobacco use, 55% of the reporting population, 29% tobacco use, 8% domestic violence, and 13% postpartum depression. Now, we know that that domestic violence is quite low. And one of the reasons that we know that is South Carolina is ranked among one of the top nations relative to the reporting, as well as intervention and maternal deaths due to domestic violence. And in South Carolina, we have data that supports some of the national figures, but it's up close and personal in that we know many of those maternal deaths occur during pregnancy. And so one of the things that we wanted, of course, like my previous colleagues, was to talk about an evidence-based integrative approach to identifying intervention treatment of substance abuse, domestic violence, depression, and tobacco use. So our expert screening went beyond just drugs and alcohol. We actually added the smoking component, domestic violence component, as well as maternal depression. Medicaid and Blue Cross Blue Shield looked at this and actually is paying for those services for up to 12 months postpartum. And so they're paying for a screening, and then they're paying for a follow-up after the point of delivery. So we do that twice within the context of working with that. And my colleagues clearly have talked about what ESPRT is, so I'm going to quickly skip that. So this is sort of the tool that is used, and it's fairly straightforward. You know, there's a series of roughly 9 questions involved. It's fairly easy. That's been translated into Spanish, which is the second most common language in South Carolina. And one of the things that is at the bottom of this is the referral patterns that are associated with all of those key agencies. And so, for example, in the Department of Health and Environmental Control that is involved with smoking cessation, there is a referral mechanism which allows us to get feedback relative to whether those individuals have been involved in treatment. With DEOTIS, which is the substance abuse agency, whether it's the Department of Mental Health or other behavioral health therapists. And then within the context of domestic violence, we've worked with the Coalition Against Domestic Violence and created a series of handouts, materials that were available in critical spots around the office, the physician's office. And one of the reasons for that is we're very much aware that many of the women who were coming into the office were coming in with partners or significant others. And the question of domestic violence was not something that was readily shared, but we wanted nevertheless to make those materials available and easily accessible in places where that danger of disclosure would not necessarily prove to be a point of contention at that individual time, followed by follow-up. 2 codes were used to bill for it. The initial screening to perform once fiscal year was reimbursed at a rate of $24. And then we looked at the brief intervention, and that was paid at the reimbursed rate of $48. Now, that does not constitute anything else that that physician may be able to do. One of the things that was clearly important to us is that we wanted to make sure that they could bill and receive reimbursement in a different code system than the traditional 9,000 CPT codes, which would have precluded them for also billing at the same time these ESPRT screen codes. So that was clearly important to us. In terms of the behavioral intervention, they may bill twice a year per fiscal. And so we do have sort of multiple steps associated with that billing process. The common elements across payers, Medicaid bundled this as part of all of their managed care programs. And so if you think about our numbers in terms of women of childbearing age in the Medicaid program, that's roughly 156,000 women who will receive an ESPRT screening, at least an ESPRT screening, at any point in time within the context of that year. The training was done in conjunction with Blue Cross Blue Shield. Similar training, similar set of trainers, and our thinking behind it was that we wanted to be able to give one solid message within the state. Public and private had exactly the same framework. We wanted to eliminate the confusion on the part of providers because we heard very clearly, if I have to bill this for private and I have to bill this for public, that doesn't work for our billing folks. And oftentimes Medicaid became sort of the lower tier in that billing system. The training also was done with all of the managed care plans and was tied to their HEDIS quality measures. And that is one of the measures. It looks at initiation and engagement in counseling for substance abuse. And so it was tied. And it was one of their connections to incentives and withholds. And so they had to improve that particular quality measure at least one standard deviation per year until they reached that 75th percentile, or it became a withhold measure in terms of removing dollars. So again, we wanted to associate the policy with clear indications of the way the program needed to be managed, and then tie it back to the Medicaid program in terms of the managed care plan, and tie it back to performance. And so we wanted all parties to be heavily invested in the process. We also looked at ongoing meetings with connections to larger South Carolina Birth Outcomes Initiative. We meet on a monthly basis, and one of the groups that meets as part of this larger Birth Outcomes Initiative is the Behavioral Health Group. And there is an ongoing meeting with all of the stakeholders at this monthly meeting, a pull-out session that addresses ESPERT and other behavioral health issues. The referral protocol was also standardized, and as a result of that, some of the agencies that were partners also began to look at those practices that were identified in that earlier map as high-need areas to provide individuals, either through substance abuse or mental health, to rotate through primary care practices where we saw large numbers. Again, the logic was, if someone was in the office, the referral was a lot easier, that connection was a lot easier, I wasn't going to a mental health center, and I wasn't necessarily going to a substance abuse center, and the building of that trust then allowed for greater facilitation of moving to another setting as appropriate. And then the other is targeting outreach and education. So this is the low birth weight hotspots for us in the state of South Carolina. And so one of the things that we very quickly realized is that some of these hotspots were also associated with some of these poor outcomes that we were looking at. These hotspots were also related to some of the poorer areas in terms of access to providers. And so one of the challenges, of course, in a managed care organization that has been sort of the movement within South Carolina, in 1992, we had roughly 72,000 individuals in the managed care model. As of my last reading of that, which was sometime last month, we have over 975,000 individuals out of 1.7 million. And by the end of this fiscal year, I would anticipate that we will have less than 200,000 individuals in a fee-for-service environment. And so it was absolutely essential to engage the managed care plan in terms of network development and what that meant in terms of addressing those gaps relative to those rural areas, which is those red areas that you see in terms of the lack of provider access or lower provider access. So as of June 2013, 46.8% or roughly 47% of women of reproductive age, 18 to 34, had received an ESPERT screening as compared to 3% at the start of the initial August 2011. Now, you know, we have some folks in our state who said, you know, we should be achieving that at much higher rates. I kind of think we've done a phenomenal job over a short period of time, and I believe that a great deal of that has to do with the policy and the integration between public and private. Of those screened, 41.4% receive an additional screening, 10.4% a brief intervention, and 2% a referral. So one of the things we're working on is that low referral rate. And that is why the heavy emphasis is taking place relative to working with the managed care plans, the mental health centers, as well as the substance abuse center, the domestic violence coalition, relative to how we can improve that. And so our initial targeted goal was screening, followed by that brief intervention, and now we're working steadily to improve those referrals and those mechanisms in place. One of the things that we felt was lessons learned is requiring physicians to complete the universal screening tool rather than other medical personnel in the office decreased the completion rates. And so very quickly we changed the billing policy to allow for that nurse practitioner or that nurse within the office to be able to do the screening and be reimbursed for it. The increasing of efficacy by training obstetric providers on the core clinical component of ESPR is important and must include related office personnel. And so not only do we train the obstetricians, we also train the office folks who are doing the claims, because we wanted to make sure that they clearly understood they could bill for that, it would be reimbursed, and that it was a clear component of what we needed in order to evaluate the efficacy of the intervention. But we also had special trainings for the nurses and gathered them together on a quarterly basis to discuss their lessons learned and what some of the issues and stumbling blocks were that they were encountering. The other thing we did is similar to Dr. Harris. At the end of each training, we asked a series of questions, whether there was an attitude change, what they learned about ESPRT, and we continued that through the first 18 months of the implementation. And we used that as information to feedback relative to how do we need it to improve the training, what issues were coming up, what were the kinds of information things that we needed to pass on to physicians, et cetera. And that's for another presentation in terms of what we found. Following patients after they left the obstetrical clinic to ensure follow through with referral treatment is challenging. It requires the exploration of other linkages to community resources and educational efforts. The Medicaid program recently implemented a community health workers program, and we have that community health workers program in key obstetrical practices where we saw a large need for connections back to community, building of that trust, as well as working with them on other related issues around that pregnancy. Managed care plans for managed care state or central partners were a requirement to play an active role in education and outreach efforts. And then public-private partnerships working together can more effectively address geographical hotspots. I showed you the Medicaid hotspots, but in reality, when we did this training and we worked with Blue Cross Blue Shield, we looked at those intersections between public and private hotspots, and that made it a heck of a lot easier in terms of dividing the training, dividing the outreach to practices. And I guess the last thing I would say to you is that the FQHCs and RHCs are a critical component as part of this. And so one of the things that we actually did was create a separate billing for federally qualified health clinics in order to be able to get them to embrace the fact that this was also a component that was essential, because we knew that they were seeing a different set of the population very early on in their pregnancy. And oftentimes before some of the women became eligible for Medicaid. And so we felt that that was also an important component. Thank you.
So I want to thank all of our panelists for the great presentations and thoughtful voting. What we agreed to at the beginning of the session was we would hold questions for the end. As moderator, what is asked of me is that I repeat the questions, but that'll keep me running back and forth a number of times. So what I'd like to do is stand here, call on those who have questions, and then whoever of the panel is to receive the question, if you would kindly repeat the question and then answer it at the microphone, that would receive. Is that okay? So questions. So I'm just going to go and read stuff.
Thank you for your question. Just to repeat it, the question was whether there's a state, what the state expectation was for ESPRT, whether we expected it to spread, or whether we're, you know, promoting it or telling, you know, giving a directive to do ESPRT. What we're doing is we have an initiative for school-based health centers, so we're finding out. I was actually working on this, leading this project with our state office of alcoholism and substance abuse services, And we, I looked into different counties in our state and found out where, the highest, prevalence of alcohol and drug use and negative consequences were. And we were contacting school-based health centers and telling them that we would like to do a pilot project of ESPERT. So we did that with a few different school-based health centers. In a sense, we could say we, do one group and do another group and, and assist them with doing this, but that can take a while, and we don't have the resources to do that. So we're trying to figure out how to spread this. And the research, that I did with the University of Albany is informing the strategy. So we are doing awareness-raising sessions and trying to get people to want to do this on their own, providing training, giving, having the resources and technical assistance. We find that they're not just going to pick it up on their own, and an awareness session probably isn't going, a standard awareness session is not going to handle it. So what do we actually have, what information do we have to give them to get them to want to pick this up, and then if they do, to implement it with fidelity.
So just to repeat your question, was there? Are you asking if there was an increase in alcohol or tobacco use at follow-up?
Provide us with information. The assist includes alcohol and tobacco, so it's a combined tool, which is one of the advantages of it. But
right.
You only provide us with information on drug use, and so often, there's comorbidity across the, there's co-use. So I was wondering if you had looked at those data and.
So for our intervention, we focused on one drug just to make it simple for the clinical trial. But as far as we did look at alcohol and tobacco use at the 3-month follow-up, and we found there was no change, and they didn't increase or they didn't decrease their use, but they did still decrease the drug of interest. Right. The doctors, the script they got was to focus on one drug, but on the bottom we also listed other substances they were at risk for just at risk for. So it was up to the doctor's discretion, but again, at follow-up with the health educators, they would try to address as much as they could, saying alcohol and tobacco use can also affect the brain just as well. So.
It might be worth dropping your card off for follow-up.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you. Yeah.
for your question, Bob. He's actually a former colleague of mine, so I'm glad for your question. Yes, we actually, a lot of research went into the workings of a school-based health center. Originally, we were thinking going into a school because of the convenience of it for students, because students say one of the research, I mean, there's been research done on reasons why students don't seek out help for substance use, and one of them is, you know, convenience, another one's confidentiality. Anyway, a school-based health center, they do try to get students to come down for annuals. That's one of the things that they do, a larger health assessment, such as the GAPS, which is ask questions about alcohol and drug use as well as like pretty much every other health topic, and they keep records of that. The issue, and it's, well, so it's like they enroll into a school-based health center. Their parents sign the permission form, and The Department of Health, which oversees them, wants at least 80% of the student body to actually be enrolled. So at that point, students, when they come in, they don't need any parental consent to get substance use services or reproductive health services. All they need is that initial enrollment and consent. So for students that are enrolled, they come in, you know, for it's their primary care provider. They're located in areas with high needs. They a lot of unmet medical needs, a lot of students receiving free or reduced price lunch. So of course, it's a population in high need of substance use services. Students come in for acute issues as well, and students who are not enrolled can come in for those types of acute issues. But they do serve primary care services for those students who are enrolled, and they try to get students to come in, and they do say that they can't get everyone to come in. So that's an issue, but it is their primary care provider. Okay, thank you for your question. And in terms of the last part of it, I did not do an analysis between nurse practitioners and physician assistants. The number was pretty low at that, so I didn't even look into it. It is a very good point and something for, there were many more nurse practitioners, it was 70% than physician assistants. And they are the key, the pretty much the main provider there. But that is very interesting and something to look into in the future. In terms of physicians, all school-based health centers have a physician on staff, and that usually the physician comes in once a month to provide services. Actually, some of the program directors are physicians, but they also have a whole range of just being, they have MDs. Some of them have just, master's degrees. Some of them are RNs. So there's a whole range, but there always is a physician that practices there is part of the healthcare system that oversees the school-based health center and will make visits to the school-based health center. So the question was, the nurses who were doing the pre-screen, what was the level of training that they received? Very good question. When we started this, we trained everyone in the clinic. So front office staff, nurses, our phlebotomists, our x-ray techs, everyone got trained not only in the ESPRT model, but also in motivational interviewing. So our nurses who were doing the triage question, doing the triage questioning, they were asking the two pre-screen questions and then usually provided a little bit of educational information. In our model, we weren't having them do the motivational interviewing, but they certainly did have the training to understand the nuances of it and to how to engage the patient in just disclosing information. Okay, so the question was about the stigma of disclosure, particularly since we had people who later on were more willing to disclose. We started with a different model than where we ended up. So our initial pre-screening model was paper and pencil. We didn't have the technology to do like an online or that sort of screening, but we did paper and pencil. So we had our front desk staff handing out a paper and pencil thing that they would then hand in when they came in for triage. What we were finding was about 50% of those were ending up in the trash in the waiting room. So, and then our nurses, this was before we had integrated it with the EHR, were forgetting to ask the questions, and so we ended up going to the verbal questioning simply to make sure that we were getting everyone. So I do think there is an issue with stigma when you're asking face-to-face, especially in a rural setting where everybody knows everybody else. And so, you know, you're doing pre-screening of the mother of somebody your child goes to school with. I mean, it's a small community. And so I think even if we go to electronic screening, knowing that that person will still see those results, I think we'll still have stigma, at least in our setting. But I think given the fact that if we can just keep asking the question, you know, I think that's about the only way we were able to get around it.
The Birth Outcomes Initiative is really the selling point because it was a partnership between all of the payers, and it was a joint commitment. And so, for example, I'm doing a presentation later on that talks about the fact that this started out with a commitment of these multiple payers to agree to eliminate unnecessary elective inductions from 37, 38 weeks. And then gradually we began to talk about all of the issues associated with birth outcomes. And the Medicaid director and the Blue Cross Blue Shield medical director, as well as having university colleagues and bringing in the research, I think has made a tremendous difference in terms of talking about the efficacy, given the challenges that, quite frankly, we face in South Carolina, of joining up. And so there's been a concerted effort across birth outcomes issues across these multiple players, including the Hospital Association. We're the only state that the hospitals all agreed to actually reduce their payment if they did not meet the targeted role of reducing 37, 38 weeks elective inductions. And so this has been a slow process, monthly meetings, continuous data feedback loops, but we're really beginning to see some good things coming out, with ESPR being a key component of that once we introduced our initial study on women of childbearing age and opioid use.
So the question was, the nurse doing the triage, did the EHR trigger an alert telling them they couldn't go past? Yes, they were unable to finish the patient and put them in the room. They had to answer the questions. So, yep.
I want to thank you all for audience members.